It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Democrats in the state Senate have reelected Dianne Hasselbein of Middleton as their minority leader.
Republicans maintain control of a majority of seats in the Senate, but Hasselbein now has four more newly elected Democrats in her caucus, eliminating the previous Republican supermajority.
Last week, we talked with Senate Majority Leader Republican Mary Felskowski. Now we turn to Senate Minority Leader Dianne Hasselbein to hear about priorities of Democrats for the new legislative session.
Hasselbein was elected to the state Senate in 2022 and previously served for 10 years in the Assembly. She was first elected to be Senate Minority Leader last December, and she represents a district serving Northwest Dane County. State Senator Hasselbein, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. Good morning.
Good morning. Your chamber now with 18 Republicans, 15 Democrats. Could this narrower majority in the state Senate create more possibilities for compromise in the legislature and with the governor?
I certainly hope so. I'm really proud of the relationships that I have with my Republican colleagues, and so I'm hoping there's more of a back and forth with camaraderie and compromise. I think those are two important words that people in Wisconsin want us to be working together to better their lives.
What is your plan for reaching across the aisle and for finding those moments of compromise with your Republican colleagues?
Well, I am meeting with Senator LeMahieu on Monday to start those conversations to see what that looks like. And then reminding the people that, you know, we got three big things done last session with Democratic votes, including shared revenue, the Brewer Stadium funding, and we did an entire reform of the alcohol licensing bill. And they needed Democratic votes to get those things done. I think the people in the state of Wisconsin are tired of just one-party rule, and I think they want us working together to making their lives better. So I always have an open door policy, and I'll continue to do that.
So last week, we talked with Senate President Mary Felskowski about her priorities for the next 2 years, and specifically her state budget priorities in light of this projected $4 billion surplus. Let's take a listen.
Of course, we have our schools are a priority. Senior citizens are a priority. Roads are a priority. But it's not always about money. We have to make sure that we have the workforce out there to complete all the jobs. You know, healthcare, mental health is a priority, but we have to have providers, not just throw money at it.
What do you think of Felskowski's priorities considering the state's current financial position?
Well, I think it's great that she wants to prioritize education. That's actually fantastic news. We do too, right? We want to bolster our K-12 schools, and mental health is super important. One of the things that we keep talking about is Medicaid expansion. You know, that's really important for us. I'm hoping we can have more conversations. We have already cost the people in the state of Wisconsin $2.6 billion by refusing to help tens of thousands of our neighbors. That's $2.6 billion we could have if we would have done this in the beginning. But we also, it's not over. We can still bring home money. It'd be $1.8 billion if we do Medicaid expansion now. We're one of the few states, I think one of 10 or something, that haven't done it yet. And it's time to get behind that.
And just for context here, a couple months ago, you solicited two Legislative Fiscal Bureau memos, one of which asked how much federal funding the state could get if it expands Medicaid in the coming two-year budget mm-hmm. cycle. And that answer was $1.8 billion. What would the state be able to do with that type of money?
Well, think about, even just things that Senator Felskowski said. We could be putting more money into K-12 education. We could be doing things for our colleges and universities. We could be bolstering apprenticeship programs all over the state of Wisconsin and get that workforce going. We could help with childcare. We have a lot of childcare deserts in our state that people don't have childcare centers to put their kids so they can get to work in the first place. These are common sense solutions that we could be working on. And if we brought that money home, we would have so many opportunities to talk about what to do with that.
Would you bring that up with Senator Devin LeMahieu when you meet with him Monday?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we'll see, what kind of conversations we have. I also have a nice working relationship with Senator Felskowski. We were in the state assembly together mm-hmm. years ago. So I'm hoping we can continue these conversations and see if we can get some things moving in the correct direction.
Other conversations you're going to have is with four new lawmakers, Democrats in the state Senate joining you. What issues do you think that, you want to make progress with them on? And what will you do as part of bringing them into the fold of the Democratic caucus?
Well, I am so excited that we have four new members. We started out this campaign season saying we wanted to keep Brad Path and then get these new four. So it was always five Senate strategy that we wanted to keep Senator Brad Path from La Crosse area and then pick up these new four. And we did exactly that. And that is something I'm really proud of. So as much as I was really distraught at the top of the ticket, what was going on with Donald Trump's reelection, I was thrilled that in a tough market, we could hold on to U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin and pick up and have all these five seats for state Democrats. One of the most exciting things, to be honest, is all of these four, and Brad as well, Senator Path as well, they knocked on tens of thousands of doors and had conversations with the people that they wanted to elect them. And I am so excited that they can bring those voices, of those constituent voices, into the state capitol, into the state senate, and we can hear what people are really struggling with back home and trying to help them with their priorities. Certainly all new four of these senators, they have a wide variety background. We have Jamie Wahl in Green Bay, a small business owner, grew up on a farm, really wants to help farmers. Kristen Elfine, Appleton Oshkosh area, small business owner. Sarah Kieski, a mental health provider. How important is that, especially when I hear Senator Falkowski talk about how important that is to have Sarah Kieski's input. It's going to be huge what we want to do. And then Jody Habish-Sinikin and all the good work she's done in that Milwaukee area. So I'm really excited about this session.
When will you start meeting with your caucus to understand what your colleagues want to prioritize and work on?
We are having a retreat on the 17th of December, but we've already been meeting. So phone calls and everything else. And they're starting to get ideas of what committees they want to serve on and also letting me know why.
We have Wisconsin State Senator Dianne Hesselbein of Middleton, recently reelected Senate Minority Leader. We're talking about her priorities of Senate Democrats in the new legislative session and how they might take advantage of the slimmer Republican majority. I want to turn to schools now, because according to the Wisconsin Policy Forum, there were a record number of school funding referendums on voter ballots this year. And you said that's because the state is not funding schools adequately. What can Senate Democrats do to help K-12 schools?
Well, we can be talking consistently and constantly with our Republican colleagues, explaining the importance of K-12 funding. Education is something that that we are required by law in this Constitution to provide, no matter where you live, no matter what your zip code. The students in Verona should be getting the same type of opportunities as the students in Milwaukee and Rhinelander and Platteville and everywhere in between in our state. And it's really, you know, it's really disappointing when you go to different school districts and they're cutting programs right and left because they can't afford to have those opportunities. So I'm going to continue to talk with my Republican colleagues and let them know how putting some of that budget surplus back into K-12 would be fantastic.
And it comes at a time when we have the largest rainy day fund. We have a $4 billion surplus. And when you say, you know, you could give some of that over to education, what do you mean by that? How, you know, how would you, where would you direct the surplus?
Well, I would like to give, you know, people are talking about, I know the Republicans have mentioned to give a large portion to some sort of relief. I'm not sure what that looks like. What I would like to do is put a large portion of that money to the school districts so that they can decide what they need. Every school district is different. I used to be on the Middleton Cross Plains Area School District Board of Education. And what they want or what they need might be very different than what another district needs. So really letting those school districts decide. Some of these school districts don't have school counselors. They might need that. They might need a mental health therapist. They might need help for just a wide variety of issues. But we also need to be funding special education funding. That is a huge issue that we are not funding right now in our state. So I would love to see that being done. But I've also heard Republicans talking about, you know, giving money back to the people. And I think we would support a targeted middle class tax relief. There's money to do both. So I'm open to having those conversations.
And I think this flows into my next question, because with targeted tax relief, you know, you said you were absolutely devastated that President-elect Trump carried Wisconsin, won a second term. There are economic issues happening there. What is your takeaway from that win in terms of the priorities of Wisconsin voters and how they're feeling?
I think voters are feeling, you know, I think they're feeling the pinch at the grocery store. I think they're wondering why the price of eggs is high, right? I think that was a real problem that maybe the Democrat message didn't talk about enough. I think some of the other things people might have forgotten, where we were when Donald Trump took election last time. I mean, we're in the middle of a pandemic. Thank goodness Joe Biden was there to provide science-based things like PPE and vaccines and believed in science, because certainly former President Donald Trump didn't believe in a lot of those things. So I think people forgot where we were.
Will this affect what issues you prioritize in office in this new term?
Will Donald Trump be our president?
Well, no. I mean, will the sentiment about these economic issues and that type of sentiment that perhaps carried this election affect what issues you prioritize as you go forward?
Thank you. Thank you for the clarification.
Sure.
Yes, I think. But, you know, if we look at what you mentioned, all those school referendums, because Wisconsin lawmakers haven't been pushing to put money into K-12 education, people have been putting referendums just to continue operating costs because they want to give that good service to the students and give them what they need. So we're asking all these school district people to, you know, raise your taxes because the state won't put the money in to do it. And that hurts them too. So if we would just fund it equitably in every single school district across Wisconsin, people wouldn't have to do this willy-nilly, district by district. Some of these referendums fail. What happens to those kids in those districts? So if we just did it right the first time, people wouldn't have to keep going back to referendum to vote to raise their taxes, which most of these referendums do.
We only have a few moments left. What is your one piece of advice you would give to your four new Democratic colleagues as they enter the state Senate?
Have hope. Have conversations with all of your colleagues on both sides of the aisle. Have some fun with this and bring those voices that you met on the campaign trail. Bring those problems that we can solve in the state capitol.
State Senator Hesselbein, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Diane Hesselbein, of Middleton, reelected as the state Senate's Democratic leader. We talked with her about the priorities of Senate Democrats in this next legislative session. And last week, we spoke with state Senate Majority Leader Mary Felskowski about the priorities of Republicans in the chamber. You can find that conversation and many others at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today.
Coming up, we'll look at the impacts of the incoming Trump administration's immigration plans on people here in Wisconsin.
We look at it and wonder how we are going to ensure that people's rights are not violated and that families are not separated.
That's coming up next here on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. President-elect Donald Trump campaigned for a second term, promising to deport millions of undocumented immigrants and make several forms of legal immigration to the United States more difficult.
Since Trump's victory, he's nominated immigration hardliners like Immigration Advisor Stephen Miller as his Homeland Security Advisor and former Immigration and Customs Enforcement Head Tom Homan as his border czar.
What could Trump's policies of mass deportation and curtailing immigration mean here in Wisconsin? Erin Barbato joins us now. She's director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Erin, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks so much for having me.
On Monday, Erin, President-elect Trump confirmed online that he is likely to use a national emergency, potentially use the U.S. military in some capacity to enact mass deportations of undocumented immigrants. As you look at that plan and the people you work with, what do you see there? What are your concerns?
I mean, there are many concerns. I think the fear that it's creating within our communities is terrifying and also detrimental to almost everyone in our communities, not just the people that are fearing deportation. But I think we look at it and wonder how we are going to ensure that people's rights are not violated and that families are not separated unjustly under our system because of the lack of resources and pro bono legal representation that's available for our undocumented community.
And working with the Immigrant Justice Clinic, what concerns are you hearing from some of the people you've worked with here in Wisconsin and others?
You know, I hear concerns from everyone, from the people that we are representing who are seeking asylum, from the people that we meet with and consult with who are in immigrant detention and Dodge, as well as people that have their green cards or have even employment-based non-immigrant visas. Everyone is terrified that they will become a target of these policies. And so it's creating a lot of unnecessary fear for people that already have their green cards or already have the right to be here, but they know that their lives are also going to become very difficult. And the barriers they're going to face in their immigration process have also become so much larger.
A lot of the focus has been on immigrants who are undocumented, have no legal status in the United States. I want to look at some other categories here. Stephen Miller, a top Trump advisor on immigration, has said that the administration would turbocharge something they did in the first administration, a denaturalization process. So people who have been through the legal immigration process, achieved citizenship, their plan would start reviewing some of those citizenship procedures and unnaturalizing people. What are you watching for there?
The process of denaturalizing someone who has already become a U.S. citizen and gone through all of the vetting and the difficult work that it takes to take that oath of allegiance to the United States, I think it's another manner in which to cause fear, because many people who have immigrated to the United States, once they have citizenship, they know that that can't be taken away through the naturalization process. And now we're bringing someone in who is invoking fear and causing more complications for people that have truly part of our society and have been here for a long time.
Can you talk just briefly about the length of that naturalization process? People talk about, you know, doing it the right way and standing in line and things like that. What goes into that legal immigration process that ends in citizenship?
In reality, most people do not even qualify to get in line to become a citizen. And once you do qualify for a line, sometimes that line is going to be 15 to 20 years long in order to just get in that line. But normally what happens if someone is eligible to get their lawful permanent resident status, if it's through marriage, they generally have to wait for 3 years. Married to a U.S. citizen, 3 years to apply for naturalization. Otherwise, people are waiting at least 5 years to apply for naturalization. And at that point, you're taking a test, you're taking an oath, you're also having your entire life reviewed by the immigration system, not just your criminal background, but also your taxes and your child support and all of the trips you've taken in and outside of the United States. It is not an easy process for people. And it also tests ability to speak English as well as understanding of the government and the history of the United States. So it takes years, many years.
Then there are asylum seekers, people who present themselves either at a point of entry to the United States or across the border in another place and make an asylum claim. That is sort of a very tentative legal status in the United States because the system is overwhelmed. People often stay in the United States during that very lengthy asylum process. What are you watching for to change in their situation under the Trump administration next year?
The asylum system was definitely torn apart during the first Trump administration, but it was torn apart additionally under the Biden administration. So the number of people that even will qualify to apply for asylum has decreased due to policies that have been put in place on the southern border. So the part that I'm really focusing on is ensuring that people will still have the right to seek asylum under our laws, and whether that's being hindered by the policies at the southern border or whether people who will be eligible for asylum can't seek asylum because they're in detention and they don't know their rights. So we're really trying to focus on how we can ensure that people have not only know their rights, but that they also have legal representation, because the consequences are truly dire for many of these people.
Something I've talked to you about in the past, Erin, in the last few years, we've seen a system, instead of having to cross the border into the United States or present at a point of entry to claim asylum, there was this online system that said, OK, you can apply and you don't have to make it into the United States and, you know, have the questions about the border crossing and things like that. What impact has that had? What are you hearing from the incoming administration about that?
So my understanding is, you know, that it's the CBP One app that people have been waiting to use in order to present themselves and apply for asylum in the U.S. My understanding is that it will be canceled. That process will be canceled. And so the people that, you know, some of the people I met with in Tijuana that were living at these shelters have been waiting for 8 months, 6 months in order to get their appointment. And if they don't get one before the administration changes, they will be unable to process in that manner. And I am not hopeful that there will be another manner for ways for people to seek asylum on our southern border.
Then there's the notion of expedited removal. We've heard from some of the incoming Trump administration talking about that, the idea that people can be removed quickly without going through court procedures. How many people could that be affected by? Is that are there likely legal challenges to that approach?
Yeah, I mean, there will certainly be legal challenges to the approach. Expedited removal was created to help control our borders and expel or deport people who are not eligible to come into the United States. But there is a very large protection within that, and that is for people who have a fear of return to their home country. And so that is part of the expedited removal process, and people need to be aware of that, especially if the Trump administration attempts to expand the use of expedited removal, which will be challenged in court. I know that, but it may still go into effect for a certain amount of time. So people really need to be aware of what their rights are and have a good understanding of what whether they have a fear of return to their home country.
Now, for people in the United States, they have some kind of legal status. If they're worried in all of these categories, worried that that could be challenged by the incoming administration, what recommendations do you have for them to get ready, to have documents and things like that ready to roll?
I mean, I think people should rely on trusted resources such as Voces de la Frontera or Centro Hispano here in Madison to know their rights and prepare, whether it is having their documents to show how long that they've been in the United States, whether there's any discretionary factors, you know, copies of their birth certificates of their U.S. citizen children, things like that. But there'll be more information coming out in the next, you know, month or two to help people ensure that they hopefully know their rights and are able to protect their families and avoid family separation when the law will provide that that relief.
And Erin, as we wrap up, you mentioned the available legal resources can be few and far between, already overtaxed for someone facing potentially deportation. Do you see efforts to ramp up pro bono or other legal work to help deal with what's going to come early next year?
There is a desire to certainly have more funding for attorneys to represent people who are facing deportation or other violations of their rights under the Trump administration. The very difficult part, Rob, is that there is no federal or state funding or city funding or county funding that is coming out in Wisconsin to help create these jobs where people can are very much needed. So there is a lack of legal representation that is available for people in Wisconsin who are facing deportation. And people do need to step up and realize that people are going to be deported without just cause and without knowing their rights if we don't have more qualified and trained immigration attorneys in this next administration.
Erin, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you again for having me.
For another perspective on the possible impacts of President-elect Donald Trump's immigration proposals here in Wisconsin, we bring in Christine Newman-Ortiz. She's executive director of Voces de la Frontera Action, a statewide membership-based immigrant and worker rights organization. Christine, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, you work, obviously, with a lot of people who could be potentially affected by policy changes in the coming administration. What kind of questions, what kind of concerns are you hearing from members of your organization and others you work with?
Because we've lived through this before, people can anticipate what we will experience. In 2016, in the first 100 days of the Trump administration, he took away enforcement priorities that the immigrant rights movement had won, so that only if you had committed a serious crime were you deportable. And it made, you know, 11 million people, regardless of, you know, their history, their family ties, how long they had been, you know, living in the U.S. And made them deportable, you know, under the threat of deportation. And so that's something that we expect to happen right away. He put in the architect of the family separation policy, and it's something that Trump has always celebrated and promised to bring back. And that is a very intentional and cruel policy of separating minors from their parents and deporting them without consideration about what's going to happen to them. And so one of the things that we are doing that we had done before is setting up regionally these Know Your Rights trainings so that people can, you know, defend themselves in terms of not just like signing away or declaring away, you know, their right to stay and to in this country, to have like kind of a legal chance. If you've been here for more than 10 years, if you have U.S., you know, citizen spouse, U.S. citizen children, good moral character, all of those things, you know, to at least have some kind of like fighting chance. And sadly and tragically, helping people with power of attorneys. So in the event parents are deported or, you know, put in detention and deportation proceedings, that their minor children will not be like stranded at school with no one to pick them up. So it's that's kind of the most immediate thing that we are doing and what people need to have in place.
During the campaign and now the transition, President-elect Trump and some of his key appointees or expected appointees as immigration-related officials have used phrases like a mass deportation, talked about workplace raids, expedited removal, where certain legal procedures might be circumvented. Do you see places where this might be different and maybe more drastic than happened in the first Trump term?
I think that, you know, we did witness, you know, the largest deportations I remember in the lead up to the 2022 gubernatorial elections that happened throughout the state of Wisconsin. And I do believe that there's going to be an effort to see what they can get away with. This is why the Know Your Rights trainings are so important. So, for example, in one case in Madison, and this was, you know, back in 2022, one father who had come to the Know Your Rights trainings knew that when he was in detention, that he should not sign a document, even though the officials were telling him and other fathers who were in detention, this is what you sign so that you can get a attorney to represent you, which was a lie. You can't lie to them, but they can lie to you and threaten you and scare you. And so he did not. He eventually, we were able to, you know, with supporting his family, you know, we were able to eventually be reunited. But the other fathers in detention who did sign did end up in deportation. There was another case of a pastor in Racine. She was from Colombia. Again, someone with an excellent record who had come to the U.S. fleeing the cartels because of the religious school that she ran and not wanting to corroborate with cartels. You know, she and her whole family was put in deportation, and she's, you know, the community really, especially the community of faith, really organized quickly around her. And while we were able to prevent the deportation of her daughter, who was a DACA recipient, and obviously kept her and the DACA recipients, who's an adult, her daughter, were able to stay united in the U.S., they did move very quickly to deport them as resistance was growing and a public opposition. So I would say there has to be a very, very strong network of people of conscience who are going to stand in solidarity with those immigrant workers and their families who are going to be targeted in this very cruel circus.
You mentioned immigrants and workers in particular, and at least some Trump likely officials in the next administration have talked about a focus on workplace raids in particular in looking for people to deport. What thoughts do you have for people, for immigrants working in Wisconsin either undocumented or maybe here seeking asylum but not having a full legal status yet? What are you watching for?
Immigrants are a very important part of our economy. 70% of the undocumented workforce in the dairy industry, the signature industry of Wisconsin, that's undocumented workers who are there. And that, you know, very large numbers in agriculture, you know, meat packing, but also in lots of other jobs, hotels, restaurants, construction, factories. You know, this is a very important workforce that has actually been helping the economy. To do that is going to shake up the economy.
We'll leave it there. Christine, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Christine Newman-Ortiz is the executive director of Voces de la Frontera Action, a statewide membership-based immigrant and worker rights organization. Earlier, we heard from Aaron Barbato, director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School. You can stay on top of all the latest news with Wisconsin Public Radio's newsletters. Get daily updates with WPR News headlines. Plus, check out weekly essays from the newsletter from To the Best of Our Knowledge, latest features from Wisconsin Life, and go behind the scenes at WPR with the Radio Waves newsletter. You can sign up for any or all of those newsletters. Head over to WPR.org/newsletter. That's WPR.org/newsletter.
Coming up, a women's group in Pewaukee celebrates 120 years of community involvement and makes the case for more people to get involved.
Giving back to others is what brings me joy.
That conversation is just ahead here on Wisconsin Today. This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story that takes place in the woods just as gun deer season begins tomorrow.
A lot of deer hunting consists of sitting around, waiting patiently in the woods for the perfect moment. As writer Ron Weber tells us, he takes the time to admire the natural world around him, the perfect moment omnipresent without a deer in sight.
There comes a time in mid-November, weeks after the kaleidoscope of color has faded, when my thoughts turn towards steely gray skies and drab woods, hopefully coated with a few inches of fresh snow, towards other like-minded folks, some whom I may not have seen since last November's gathering, but whose company feels as comfortable as a favorite recliner, towards the coming of those 9 special days, in that many ways gives the rest of the year meaning. Too excited to sleep, I will rise early and get myself ready. My memory conspires with my imagination to fill my mind with visions of what possibilities await. After a long walk, as I sit motionless, I sense the dark woods slowly lightening, candle by candle, as the sun painstakingly inches up the horizon. The stillness and quiet is searing, interrupted only by the occasional and startling popping of trees as sap freezes and expands. It is a perfect morning. A couple hours later, the views are now crisp, the green needles of the hemlock and balsam fir standing out brilliantly against the snowy backdrop. A flash of movement to my left catches my attention. My eyes instinctively focus on the spot, but I see nothing moving. Then another flash as a short-tailed weasel, sporting a white coat for the winter, darts out from under a large fallen yellow birch log on whose stump I am seated. The weasel inquisitively approaches the end of my boot, with the black of its tiny eyes and tip of tail, all that keeps it from perfectly blending into the snowy background. It jumps onto my boot, but instantly must realize it doesn't feel right, and again in a flash retreats back under the birch log. Though I never see it again, I am ever thankful for our brief encounter. As the sun continues its arc, I am visited and entertained by others. A gray jay quietly appears, flitting from branch to branch just above me, seemingly unconcerned with my presence. Funny how nature designed this bird to be the alter ego of its more raucous cousin, the blue jay. Red squirrels come and go, one in particular who has decided to play a game of chicken with me. It sidles up closer and closer, within an inch or so of my leg and my boots, but then spooks and retreats, only to repeat the game time after time. I guess some might be annoyed, but I can only admire its persistence and curiosity. The sun is well past its zenith now, and inching down towards the southwest horizon. The light is beginning to fade as the candles go out one by one. In the half light, I catch movement of a larger animal moving up out of the spruce bog. Could this be what I have been waiting for? Out of the shadows of the hemlock, a coyote and then a second appear. Two fellow hunters whose skills I respect, as unlike me, they have no hot meal waiting for them at the end of the day if their hunt is unsuccessful. I wish them luck as they fade from sight. As always, my hunt has been nothing but successful, and I would not want to share a camp or campfire with anyone who would argue otherwise. As I retrace my boot tracks through the darkening woods towards my vehicle, I think about all I have been blessed with this day. The sunrise and sunset, the weasel, jay, squirrels, and coyotes, the snow hanging on the hemlocks, the quiet, the stillness, all of it, and they call it deer hunting.
Ron Weber is a writer and forester who lives in Weyerhaeuser. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
For more than 100 years, community members across Wisconsin have dedicated themselves to local women's clubs.
In 1896, the state joined the General Federation of Women's Clubs. The community service organization brings women together for volunteer work in their communities.
In southeastern Wisconsin, one local club is celebrating its 120th anniversary. That is the GFWC Women's Club of Pewaukee. From crime prevention to homeless support to dementia awareness, its 101 members strive to enrich the community.
Abby Lorenz is a member of the GFWC Women's Club of Pewaukee. Abby, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, now, 120 years for the Women's Club there in Pewaukee. For people who aren't familiar with these organizations, can you give us the basics of the kind of mission, the kind of work you do?
Absolutely. There are women's clubs not only in Wisconsin, not only in the United States, but around the world. We are under the international umbrella of the General Federation of Women's Clubs, and we all have the same mission, which is enhancing our community through volunteer service.
How did you first get involved in the club there in Pewaukee?
Well, I have an interesting story to share with you about that. In 2010, I was invited to be a guest speaker at the Women's Club of Pewaukee monthly meeting. And I went as a representative of the Pewaukee Area Arts Council. We did a fun haiku poem and we had a great time. And then when I finished speaking, the president of the club stood up and said, well, now we are going to decide whether or not we're going to dissolve the club. Eyes opened real wide and I said, wait, I put my hands up. You can't dissolve this wonderful organization because I'm joining and I'm going to invite all of my friends, and our club practically doubled in the first year.
a lot of civic organizations and volunteer groups and things like that are dealing with situations just like the one you said. Since that time, since you joined, have you had success in spreading the word and making sure that the local club isn't on the verge of dissolving?
Absolutely. I am so pleased to say that today we have over 100 members, and that didn't come easily. It happened by inviting friends, and just like the commercial where you tell a friend and that friend tells a friend, it really is word of mouth for joining the Women's Club, and everybody is welcome to join. We invite all ages. Many of the Women's Clubs are aging, and so we are looking for younger members and join our mission of enhancing our communities through volunteer service.
Now, I work here at Wisconsin Public Radio. It's an organization with a history of a little over 100 years. I really feel that, like I'm part of something that goes back into time. Well, now you've got me beat. You've got 120 years you're celebrating this year. What does that mean to you to be part of, you know, this line of people who have stewarded this organization through the decades?
It's an amazing feeling knowing that women 120 years ago didn't even have the right to vote. And today I was up in front of the club encouraging our members to vote. So we are very blessed to have the opportunity to share so many different opportunities for women to share their gifts, their talents. We have what are called community service programs that are internationally known. They're called arts and culture, civic engagement and outreach, education and libraries, environment, and health and wellness. So one of the things that you may not know about the General Federation of Women's Clubs is that most of the local libraries throughout the state of Wisconsin and even throughout the United States were formed by women in women's clubs. So it's very exciting to know that we have a very rich history, and I'm so proud to be a part of this great organization of women.
What kind of things are you doing this year, or have you done this year, to mark the 120-year milestone?
I'm so happy to announce that we just finished last month a beautiful celebration where we held the Razzle Dazzle 120th Anniversary Gala, where we had over 150 guests, men and women. It was a black tie event, and we were so blessed to be able to accept some proclamations, both at the local level, the county level, and even at the state level. We received a beautiful letter from Governor Evers.
We're talking to Abby Lorenz about the Wisconsin General Federation of Women's Clubs and the 120th anniversary of the local club in Pewaukee. Abby, I want to dig into some of the specific work you've been doing there. One of the big signature projects you've been working on for some years now is dementia-friendly Pewaukee. Can you tell us a little bit about the goals and what people in the community are seeing from that?
Yes, of course. Dementia-Friendly Pewaukee is a fairly new community outreach of the Women's Club of Pewaukee and through the county, through the ADRC, which is the Aging Development Resource Center in Waukesha County. We started back in 2010 with a community-wide gathering of our leaders, really. And so we called it a coalition. We talked about and brainstormed all different ways that we can inform and educate the community about dementia, because many of our baby boomers' parents are aging, and we are experiencing very high numbers of dementia. So we felt it was very important to establish an educational program that would not only help the caregivers, but also be kind to those with dementia. So we started education through training local businesses in Pewaukee, as well as just the general public. Like the whole Women's Club of Pewaukee at one time received the training for what to do if you have somebody in your life or even in the local grocery store or the bank, what you can do to help somebody with dementia. So basically, this became and quickly grew into Pewaukee's signature project. We started again with educational awareness,
and it has quickly grown to hosting two educational workshops annually, as well as having monthly caregivers coffees. Now, this is a peer-to-peer group, which enables the caregiver to talk one-on-one with others in the same situation. So they share their experiences, their stories, and they may get some tips of how to deal with their loved one with dementia. We then also meet with the loved ones with dementia, and we do art projects with them. We have partnered with the Pewaukee Area Arts Council, and I am also a professional pianist and vocalist, so I do a fun sing-along with the people with dementia.
Abby, you've had some success recruiting members to your local women's club. You're in competition with a lot of other things that people do with their time, raising kids, their jobs. Make the case to people listening to say, hey, this isn't more work. This is actually something you are going to take something away from and benefit from getting involved like this.
In the state of Wisconsin, the General Federation of Women's Clubs have 43 active clubs within five districts throughout the state. So our total membership, just to give you a little idea of numbers, we have 1,457 women that are actively engaged and participating in their local community through the Women's Club. We do have a General Federation of Women's Club signature project, which is domestic violence awareness and prevention. And the Wisconsin clubs supported this international project primarily through educational programs and donations. I want to also share with you some interesting statistics about the 43 clubs. We completed over 1,500 projects with a total of nearly 98,000 volunteer hours in 2023. To join the club, it's very, very easy. If you know of the name of the club in your own community, simply give them a call and talk to their membership director, and you'll hear all about how to join your local club.
I want to ask more about what drives you, Abby. I'm really lucky in my job. I get to talk to people around the state. What is the magic secret, Abby, that drives you to say, hey, I'm going to do something that makes a positive difference in my community through, in this case, the Women's Club?
Well, Rob, I'm just grinning from ear to ear because I can honestly say that giving back to others is what brings me joy. By giving of your time, of your talents, this is what kind of fills my cup, so to speak. And when I feel good, it's usually from doing some random act of kindness, doing good things in the community, helping to raise funds for local nonprofit arts organizations. That's what I'm all about. I love the arts. My husband, Kent, and I are big supporters of the Wisconsin Philharmonic and other arts organizations. And so you can see just from my voice how much I really enjoy giving back because it just brings me such happiness.
Abby, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing your work with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Abby Lorenz is a member of the Pewaukee Women's Club, which is part of Wisconsin's General Federation of Women's Clubs. They're celebrating their 120th anniversary this year.
We've talked about Cozy Mysteries with Wisconsin Ties in a couple of times lately, a book set in the fictional version of Lake Geneva, and a play set in a Wisconsin supper club.
And we heard from listeners who are fans. Sherry texted, as anyone in my life could tell you, I'm a big fan of the genre, slowly working my way through the works of Agatha Christie. Agatha stays away from the violence and writes more on the relationships between people, usually ordinary people. She sometimes throws in a bit of a love story, which I appreciate.
Sherry likes audiobook versions while driving all over the state for work, plus TV adaptations on PBS.
Another listener writes, a retired librarian friend, also a cozy reader, recommended a series by Jean M. Dams, born and raised in Indiana, who writes in the style of the English cozy, a Dorothy Martin mystery. It's an American expat in a Southeast England community solving unlikely murders in interesting places.
Keep sharing away your cozy mystery favorites. Call or text us at 888-642-0232, or you can email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.